The music is probably the dopest music that's happening right now in the background. Welcome to Diversity Hires. I'm Shukri, aka Shu. My partner over there is
Sherman Payne, greatest screenwriter of all time. I'm just gonna put that into the air right now.
The GSOT?
Yeah, the G-Swope.
The G-Swope. I love it.
Talking to the G-Swope right now.
That's great.
How you doing, Shu?
G-Swope. I'm all right. I it's a crazy time in the world, as it always is. We are recording here from Los Angeles, California, where we're in the middle of another surge of COVID-19. Which has us all in our houses and all sort of like semi-quarantined, although we can go out, you know, here and there. But let's jump in. We could jump into the show, man. We said we were going to talk about sort of what it means to be the title of the show. This is our first episode.
Let's back up because allow us to properly introduce ourselves. You know, this is a show about screenwriting. We are two working screenwriters in television and film and producing as well. And we thought that we could add some insight into what it's like to be a screenwriter from a specifically Black perspective.
That's right. That's right.
And that's why we're called the Diversity Hires.
That's right. That's the name of the podcast. And for those who don't know, who might be listening, what is a diversity hire? We named that podcast that our tongue is a little bit in our cheek there, but but you know, diversity hire is a common name term for someone who ends up on typically a television staff, writing staff, or maybe gets some other writing job through a variety of diversity programs. And they come in different iterations, which we could talk about. The diversity hire, both the term and the position itself, is a bit of a double-edged sword. And just briefly, I'll give a brief, you know, sort of what a diversity hire is.
Yeah, please.
So typically most studios and television networks have, it's commonly called, or the parlance is, a diversity slot, which basically means that any person from one of the five protected classes can get a seat or get a position as a writer on a television show that the television show itself, that production, doesn't have to pay for. So essentially they provide money for one season. Some studios make it two seasons, but one season typically for a writer from a diverse background to be on that staff. It incentivizes, the point is, it incentivizes showrunners to be able to hire people from diverse backgrounds because they don't have to pay for that person.
Right, so back up for 1 second, because first of all, you've had experience as a diversity hire, which we'll talk about. Showrunners have a budget for a writing staff, and it's a agreed upon contractual number that they can spend to hire new writers, experienced writers, co-executive producers, all up and down the hierarchy of writers. And so what you're saying is that the studio, in these particular cases, to incentivize hiring minority writers, says, we will take one of those slots off your plate. We'll pay for one of those writers totally outside of your budget, so it's no cost to your bottom line, in order for you to hire somebody who might not normally get a shot because they're a minority.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's absolutely correct. That's how it works. Now, where it can become problematic is that, and a lot of this is changing in the current Hollywood. We'll see where these diversity, quote, diversity slots end up in the next year or two and how they change. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that if you can get people in the door, then once they're there, then the next year when the studio is not covering their cost, that the showrunner will be so impressed with their work or so deem that person so valuable that they will promote them and bring them on to continue on the series. The problem is that doesn't often happen because people are seen as, quote, diversity hires and thus less valuable. or they once the showrunner has to sort of pay for that person out of their budget, lots of questions get asked, and they don't necessarily want to do that. So you have people that have repeated the quote diversity hire step as a staff writer many times, which affects sort of their ability to be promoted, and then affects the number of diverse people from diverse backgrounds in those middle and higher positions because they don't get promoted. So,
right. And I imagine that if you're a showrunner who has taken a risk on a diversity, you've hired somebody in a diversity hire slot, the studio's paying for it, so you haven't taken a financial risk, but you still have somebody in your room that you maybe normally wouldn't hire. Once you have to pay them out of your own pocket and that diversity hire money ends, you might hold them to a much higher standard than you would another writer, right? Because now they're going to count against your budget.
Yes. I think you gotta, I think it creates a weird thing where you have to prove yourself almost even more. Because someone you, just like you said, someone you were paying for before, now you gotta pay for them again. You gotta pay for them a little bit more because they're probably gonna be promoted, but it's a different thing. It's a different calculus than you've never cost me anything, and now I've got to, do I have to let another writer go in your place? Do I have to not promote someone else? What are the sort of challenges to that?
It's weird because on the front end, it sort of incentivizes hiring that person.
Yes.
But on the back end, it sort of incentivizes firing them. Yes, it's like a very weird, nebulous place to be in for a year. Talk a little bit about your experience, man, because I don't think I've ever been a diversity hire. I've been on a couple staffs. I was a showrunner. I was a staff writer once. I was a staff writer once. I don't think I was technically a diversity hire, although I would have no way of knowing. But you do know that your first TV job, you were in that diversity hire slot. Can you talk a little bit about your experience and how it helped or hindered your career going forward?
Sure. Like, well, you raise a good point because no one technically knows. I mean, it's not like somebody, you go into your first day of work and there's a placard at your desk that says diversity hire or something. Nobody technically knows. And if you're in a diverse room where you're not the only Black person, hopefully they would never really know. But I knew because of the way I got my first job. It's something that I'll break this down into two parts. It's something that agents typically, when they're trying to break in a new client in television, there are a few ways that they can go about it. One is if a person has a script, they try to get that script sold or optioned or whatever. Another way in is to try to get that person, if it's a person from a diverse background, to get that person in the quote diversity slot. So they know that. They know what we just said. They know that every staff has a diversity slot available. How is that slot going to be filled? A lot of times that slot is filled by graduates from these programs that you, if you're listening to this podcast, probably know, the Disney program, the Fox program, the Warner Brothers Writers Workshop, whatever. All those diversity or pseudo diversity programs, people that come out of there typically fill quote diversity slots in television. But there's not enough of them to fill all of them. So some of them are just available. And by the way, showrunners don't have to hire these people. Mm-hmm. It's just an option for them. So when we were looking around, my agent made it very clear to me in his nice way that we were going to try to get you into a diversity slot. That's how we're going to try to break you in. So when it came to my first job, I knew that they were looking for a diversity hire. When I got my interview with my showrunner and all that, it was never brought up, never mentioned. When I met with the studio and the network, never mentioned. And then I was finally hired. Mm-hmm. And it never came up for me. My first room was six people. It was on a show called Satisfaction at USA. Six people in a room. I was not the only Black person. I was promoted after the first year. And you know, there.
So that's a success story then, in that case,
I think,
right?
So yeah. I mean, I think a coworker of mine who was a staff writer, who's my friend, that got a double bump, I think. So I may have still only gotten one bump as opposed to his two.
So they, white guy, just for friend. People understanding, there's a very specific hierarchy in television writing rooms. It goes staff writer, story editor, executive story editor, co-producer, so on and so forth, all the way up to executive producer. And a double bump means that you basically skip a rung. He skipped one rung, or he skipped two rungs?
We both came in as staff writers.
Uh-huh.
I was promoted to story editor.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure he was promoted to executive story editor. So he skipped the story editor to slot.
He sunned you, bro. He's totally, he came in there, he wrecked shop. I'm about to leave Shakri in the dust.
But that being
no response from the always classy shoe.
No response. I mean, who knows? I don't know what the reason was, but I was promoted and brought onto the payroll, as far as I know. Maybe Universal had a 2-year thing with diversity hire. I don't know.
Yeah. So I don't know.
But it helped. I will say, being promoted though, and having that title helped me. I very quickly got out of the staff writer rung, the low level position. And then it helped me with next jobs, because I never had to repeat anything. I always made the case, and my agents made the case, that he's been promoted, he's at this position, he can be at the next position, he can keep moving up the ladder.
Which is tough, right? Because as we know, statistically, Black writers, people of color, are more often asked to repeat the entry level step of staff writer than other demographics, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's all I can say.
Yeah. And you know, no. I mean, it does go to why it's sort of one of the many reasons why it's harder to climb up the ladder as a Black writer, if you're asked to sort of do the entry level job when the bump is considered automatic for other people. You can see how people very quickly could surpass you, and after 3 years, you could be stuck in the same exact spot, and your colleague who started with you could already be an executive story editor or co-producer, which is a significant difference in the amount of income, but also will affect you significantly on what kind of jobs you can get going forward.
Absolutely. I mean, you've heard stories of people being trapped at staff writer for 3 different seasons, you know, for example. And I think that certainly happens. And a lot of it has to do with, man, I mean, there's a lot of reasons, probably, where a lot of it's speculation. I mean, we all can just kind of guess from being in writer's room.
Yeah.
A lot of what happens with whether to be promoted or not, or whether even to be brought back to the show.
Yeah.
I find this there's a certain amount of it that has to do with one's writing, certainly. But most of it is personal.
Dude, there are so many. Let me put it out there. Shakri, you're being too diplomatic today. Let me say, there are a lot of whack writers who go up the rungs in television very, very quickly.
Yes.
It's like social promotion in school.
Yes.
You don't know your times tables. Why are you going on to the next grade? You don't know your times tables. Well, they say you're the right age. It's social promotion. And I think that happens in writers' rooms so often.
Yes.
The dopest writer could be passed up by somebody who the showrunner just personally likes.
Correct.
Now, part of that is valid, right? Because TV rooms have a lot to do with chemistry and a lot to do with people sort of playing their role. You may be a whack writer, but you might have great ideas that lead people to great episodes.
Yes.
It's not a meritocracy, which I think is so frustrating if you are the greatest screenwriter who ever lived, for example.
Sherman Payne,
the G-Swote. Do I have the acronym right? I think I got it right.
You're splitting screenwriter into two words.
Two words.
But I like that.
It flows off the tongue a little bit easier. But if you are the G-Swote, it could be frustrating to watch people get promoted all around you for reasons other than what's on the page. So
yes.
TV there's not really the opportunity for that to happen in other forms of screenwriting, specifically for film. But in TV, you could be, next thing you know, an executive producer on a show and not really have the pen game to support it. That's
the
super
pen game.
The pen game, bro.
The pen game.
And so
Okay. Yeah. But here's the thing. Okay. I don't care. We're going to veer off. I don't care.
Let's veer off it.
Let's veer off. The pen game. Who has real pen game in television and film screenwriting? In my opinion, not very many people, especially in television. And
definitely in television. And I'm talking to all y'all.
And I'm going to tell you why I think that is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, first of all, the people that really have pen game are people that write literature. But that's a separate thing.
That's another topic. Disagree.
Literature and rappers. Those would be my two people. Those are my two influences. But that's who I think really has pen game. But
Cormac McCartney and Kendrick Lamar. That's the list.
But okay, in terms of television, I'm gonna tell you why I don't think why it's hard to find people with pen game. When you're hired on a television show, let's say you spend 20, 25, 30 weeks, maybe more, in a room, 5, 6, 8 other people. You're a writer. You've done all you can to, if you're new to breaking in, all you can to write well, to get into this room, right? And whenever that was in your career, whether that was yesterday, you just broke into this room, or whether that was 25 years ago and you broke into this room, that was probably the last time that you wrote your way into something. And here's why. Because of those 40 weeks that you're going to spend in the writer's room, do you know how much time you're going to write? Maybe 5% of that time.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, you're being a professional, as I like to say, a professional talker.
Yeah.
You're a professional writer, but your job is mostly talking about story, talking about ideas, talking about characters, talking about blah, 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 blah. And all that's valuable and it helps to hone one's craft in one way, but you are not writing.
Yeah.
And so I think it takes a special or different kind of person and a different kind of approach, a different kind of writer to know that and to then say, I'm going to do whatever I can to keep my pen game up because I can't do it sitting on this staff. But there's no way to.
But see, this is the thing. And this is why those people are whack, bro. Because.
Which people?
I can't name names. But it's not that kind of podcast. But what I will say is, you and I know, and not to big ourselves up too much. G-Swode is a joke, but let's move on. We both are interested in always writing our own shit.
Yes.
And I can speak for myself. I never stop writing my own shit. Like, sure. I am always out to get hired to write something that I can call my own. And failing that, I'm going to be writing my own stuff for free on spec. So I think there are a lot of people who find comfort in the TV room. A lot of people are scared of the blank page. Those people are not writers. They are professional talkers. They are looking to get the social promotion to the next level. That's fine, man. It is a job. And you can make a great career in television writing doing just that. But then there are people who are much more hungry, who are out there not only working their quote-unquote day job in a writing room, you know, helping the room, being a good team member, trying to give the showrunner what they want, which is all an important aspect of the job. And then they're going home and they're finding time to write their own stuff. Those are the sharks. I will say that, look.
I'm with you.
Okay, good. I will say that screenwriting as opposed to television writing, screenwriting for film, you're butt naked out there, man. You know what I mean? Like that, you're really butt naked out there. If you're not in television writing your own spec pilots or writing pilots for hire, you're really writing somebody else's show. You're writing the room show and you're writing the showrunner show. And it's very difficult to differentiate where your writing begins and everybody else's ideas end.
It's fucking impossible. Yeah.
When you write a movie, When you write a movie, you are alone. You're alone. There's no room to cover for you. There's no showrunner to do a final pass. You can't blame it on necessarily the pace of producing television, which is extremely fast paced. So, you know, I just think that there's a certain comfort in the television writing rhythm and the way that the room and the hierarchy works that can provide a lot of cover for people who are not really writers. And that's fine. Again, they got a job, but I got big problems with that. And I'm talking to everybody again. Nobody is exempt from this criticism. If you think I'm talking about you, it's because I am.
I love it.
Well, okay, wait.
Well, okay, go ahead.
You have a final thought?
No, I was gonna segue.
Okay, let me segue.
Go ahead.
All right. So the question I wanted to ask you is, are these diversity programs working? Because the WGA recently put out a report about inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at, specifically in television, what is fast approaching parity. Not quite there, but we are making huge strides in diversity in television. 44% of the television writers are women, which of course is short of the 51% that they actually are in society, but it is closer than it's ever been.
Sure.
35% of the writers are people of color. That again is a far way off from what it actually is in the American population, but it is a big difference than it was a few years ago. And according to an analysis of this report, you know, we are just a few years away from achieving real parity if we continue to make these gains. So the question for you, Shu, is, are these diversity initiatives working?
Yes and no. And yes and no. They are working in the sense that, and I'm going to speak specifically about television, and I'm going to segue to movies. Working in television. They're working in television in the sense that we're talking about the WGA inclusion report, by the way, which was just released this summer of 2020. But it pulls on data from 2019. So it is working in the sense that those numbers that you suggest are pulling closer to parity. And in terms of amounts of sheer numbers, numbers of people in writing rooms, et cetera, that seems to be trending very much in the right direction. And really, you know, we talked about this a little bit offline, but a real difference from like 10 years ago. I mean, 2019 is really different from 2009, for example, when you get those numbers. So that's great, okay? The no part is, numbers do not equal influence. In many ways, in general, you would think that they do, because if I have, you know, more numbers in a given space, then I can have more influence.
Yeah.
But that is not necessarily, it is not equal, is not equitable, you know, numbers to influence in a television room, because in a television room, one person has outsized influence. The showrunner is the buck stops there.
Yeah.
It's their vision, it's their show, it's what they want to do. So they decide, they are the final decider of all scripts, of all ideas, of all everything.
Right.
Yes, in connection with the network and the network executives also. But so because you have a lot of people in the writing room doesn't mean that their influence is as equal as the showrunner. When you really look at the amount of showrunners that are Black or people of color, there are very few. I think the number is less than 5%, if I'm not mistaken. It's a very, very small number. So, and of those numbers that you mentioned, most of those people fall in the mid-level or low-level television writers in terms of hierarchy.
Yeah.
I think that's even more evidenced when you look at the number of movie screenwriters.
Let's I have a couple facts.
Go ahead.
Black people in movie screenwriting make up only 7% of the screenwriters. Black people's population as a share of the United States of America's population is close to 14% right now. Latino screenwriters make up less than 5%, 4.7% of film screenwriters, and Latino people are something like 18 or 19% of the U.S. population. Why, the question I have for you, and I have my own thoughts about this, but I'll pose it to you first, why the disparity between television? Why does television, you know, power dynamics aside, from a sheer number standpoint, why does television seem to be trending in the right direction and movies are stalled at these abysmal numbers?
Well, I'm going to say something that might seem a little counter, but I actually think the numbers are saying the exact same thing.
That does sound counter. Please explain.
I don't think they're saying, because it's exactly the point that you made earlier. As a film screenwriter, you are butt naked out there, meaning that it is you.
Yeah.
It is your thing. It is your influence. It is, yes, you got to listen to the studio. Yes, there are other people chirping in your ear, but it is all about you, your voice, your influence, you putting pen to paper, right? Uh-huh.
Yes.
In the television space, the equivalent of that person is the showrunner. It's about you. Your vision, your people, yes, you have network, blah, 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 blah. But it's your vision on the page, right? That's
so you think there's sort of an auteur thing going on?
Of course.
The auteur of a movie screenwriting setup is the screenwriter.
Correct.
In the writing sense. And in the television world,
it is the
one person who is the executive producer, creator, showrunner.
Correct.
Whoever falls in that category. Yeah.
Correct. And both of those spaces are dominated by white men. Either way you look at it. So, yes, there are more because you got 10 people in a writer. And I'm not knocking that progress. Don't get me wrong. But because you have 10 people, 7, 8, 10 people in a writer's room, yes, it's good to have. There's more opportunity to put more people in those seats that are diverse, right? It's more opportunity to do that, and people have pushed to do that, and that's great. And it should, but the numbers say exactly the same thing, which is that the voices, the influence, the creators, the sort of auteurs of the stories are still overwhelmingly white dudes.
I can't even argue with that, bro. I think that we should have a dynamic where, like one of those ESPN debate shows, where we always take the opposite side of the debate no matter what, but that actually made so much sense. I don't have much to add. I will say one thing, though, which is I think TV writing rooms have become public facing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not your average television viewer, but a lot of TV viewers know the name of the showrunner who is making their favorite show. That used to not be the case, right? Showrunners have sort of become stars in a way that film directors are in a certain respect. And as a result, their writing rooms have become a lot more public facing. You can go on to a lot of your favorite shows and look at their writing room's Twitter, where you can sort of discern who the people in the room are, and you can look at the Instagram accounts and find more information about television writers than you can about other types of writers. And I think part of that public facing nature has really brought shame into the picture. I think as a liberal white showrunner, which most showrunners are liberal and white, you do not want to be the one person who has your room's Instagram post filled only with white faces. And so I think there is a level of shame, because how do you hold a film studio accountable in the same way? There is no public-facing nature of film development. You don't know who's writing the next movie that's going to come out, because you probably never even heard of it. There is no social media account for Sony Pictures or for Fox, right? Like, or Disney. Right. There's no Twitter account you can go to see all of the screenwriters we're currently hiring. Yeah. It doesn't exist. So part of it, I think, is a little disingenuous in a way, because if there wasn't that public facing nature that's become really, really part of the cultural conversation in the past few years, I don't think that you would have nearly as many black people in really? Screenwriting room. Well, no, I do not. You know what? I do not.
I think that's a great point because, I think that's the space that all these reports, because the WGA puts out an inclusion report.
Yeah.
UCLA puts out a Hollywood diversity report. The great organization Color of Change often puts out reports on the entertainment industry. And so there has been, at least in the last several years, this push to not only just talk about diversity or talk about inclusion, but to try to like expose when it's not apparent. Do you know what I mean? Put numbers behind it. And you're right. There isn't a sort of, but you know, who reads those reports? People in our business,
yes.
But the general public doesn't. The general public sort of, you know, sees the Twitter handles.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, again, you can follow your favorite network show's writer's room.
Yeah,
you can see it. There was a whole initiative. I don't know, maybe a year or two ago. Show Us Your Room, which mm-hmm. was specifically about holding people to account about the visual racial makeup of their rooms and the gender dynamics of their rooms. So that's my theory about it. One thing I wanted to get to real quick is something that you posted about on social media, was the CBS initiative. According to Deadline, the broadcaster is committing 25% of its script development budget to projects from creators, writers, and producers who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. And let's see, they also have committed to get their rooms to be 50% people of color by the 2022-23 season. How do you feel about this?
I think it's amazing. And I think it's exactly the right kind of thing to do. And as far as I know, right now, CBS is, and I guess it's sort of CBS Viacom together, I'm not quite sure, but CBS is the only place to do this or to have. Here's what I like about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's measurable, number one. So there are specific numbers. There are goals attached to it. The goals attached to specific numbers. And I think those numbers are perfectly reasonable. The second thing I like about it is it puts a timeline on it. So it's not only are the goals, but the goals in within a certain time, right? Which also makes it easier to measure. The next thing I like about it is that this is to our previous point that it's not just about rooms, because it recognizes in the initiative, it recognizes that yes, we can have half of our writers' rooms be people of color and still not have the right kind of influence. So we need to make a certain amount of our development, which is working with creators of television shows.
Mm-hmm.
So our development needs to be at least a quarter of our development. I hope it says at least, but at least a quarter of our development needs to be with Black creators.
Yeah.
And that's now why CBS? Because CBS in Color Changes report in 2017, I believe.
Among the worst.
The worst offenders. Yeah. The worst offenders. I mean, almost no Black people on their staffs, no Black creators. So, you know,
that's what I was going to say, is that as much as you give them props on one hand, on the other hand, you have to go, yeah, but you were the worst.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you were literally, you had tons of shows with not one person of color on the staff. So props to them for, you know, course correcting, you know, props to them. But it's a little bit like the Redskins changing their name. Once you get called out enough and sponsors start to fall off and people, it really starts to become part of the public conversation that you're whack at diversity, you have to swing big at that point. But if they follow through, yo, the proof is in the pudding, right? Like you can't argue with results. Let's hope that they follow through. And good luck to everybody writing on a CBS procedural.
Eesh, that's rough. But look, I gotta say, like I was contacted not too long, like within this, I have even told you about this. So I was contacted
within
the last week, I can't say by who, but to do a project for CBS, right? And I gotta tell you, man, I considered that. It made me feel personally like, well, shit, yeah, I want to be part of that. If they're going to put their money where their mouth is, then Okay. You know what I mean? Yes, their past has been a little shaky, of course. But all right, if it's for real, then let's talk about it at least. You know.
See, me, I would be sort of like, is this? I'm already the greatest screenwriter of all time, so why didn't you hit me up before? That. Yeah, and by the way, CBS, holler at me. Easy to find. I would love to write the next procedural for the Midwest demographic. Everybody will love it. I don't think it's ad revenue.
I don't think it's the same CBS. I think they're trying to.
That's different. We'll see.
I think that it's not a Les Moonves CBS anymore. So.
Oh, that's a whole nother topic. We have so many deep topics we can go into.
I know.
Real quick, we should probably wrap up soon. We've been talking for a minute, but.
I feel like we didn't actually talk about anything, though. What did we talk about?
Sure. Don't undercut our show on the actual recording. Wait till after.
All right, edit this out.
Not saying it. It's for sure saying it. I was going to talk to you and see if you wanted to discuss a little bit about, since we're talking about CBS, the big firing that took place over at CBS.
Yeah. For those who don't know, sort of notorious, I never worked for him, but a notorious showrunner, Peter Lenkoff, was fired. Notoriously abusive, racist, homophobic. I mean, just I think every, you know, kind of ill that you could put on a boss seems like he had that reputation. What strikes me about it is that, you know, he worked for a long, long time. And, you know, stuff has been floating around about that guy forever. And it just makes me think, you know, how many of those people are still out there working and people can't really say anything because they need their jobs and, you know. Kind of sucks. Hollywood protects those people, unfortunately.
You know, it's the deification and the glorification of, I don't know that we call many showrunners genius, but just like your ability to produce art, specifically in the world of television, on time and under budget.
Yes.
And that sort of makes you a god in the world of TV, and you start to become a little bit untouchable. It's like a tenured professor. Like,
yes,
we'll let a lot of shit slide if you have that sort of you've been knighted as a good showrunner,
because there's so much money. There's so much money on the line.
Millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he had three shows, so you can take whatever a normal showrunner, their operating budget, and you know, he probably had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars under his control at any given time. I wanted to use this as an opportunity to talk to you about, as somebody who's been in lots of TV rooms, I've been in several TV rooms as well. What are the qualities that make a good showrunner? Obviously, I mean, we don't have to go into much detail. If you're verbally abusive, if you're racist, if you're homophobic, if you have a good old boys club at the top and you're artificially suppressing women and writers of color, then you're whack and you, that makes you a bad showrunner. What are the things in your experience that make a great showrunner? And what are the things you're going to aspire to when you are running your own show?
Well, I really want to throw this back to you because, I mean, I'm going to answer, but I really want to throw this back to you because I feel like you have a particular affinity for a certain showrunner that I think you should talk about.
First of all, I want to say, and this is honest, I joke around a lot. I've never had a bad showrunner. Period.
Okay.
I've never, you know, I actually have liked all the showrunners that I've worked for. I think that they have all been, none of them have been verbally abusive. They've all been pretty understanding. And I think that they all have a real, they've all been white, but I think they all have a real interest, a genuine interest in diversity. So props to all my showrunners. You could look up IMDb and figure out who those people are. They're all great. And I'm not just blowing smoke. I really feel that. I will say that what one thing that I've discovered that's really, well, the first two things I think are important for any managerial job, but especially for a television showrunner, which is communication.
Mm-hmm.
Being a clear communicator is the most important thing. You hear writers get super frustrated with showrunners and they feel like they have to read their minds, that there's a moving target of what you're supposed to hand in. Clear communication on anywhere from schedules, due dates, to notes and how you want the show to be to come out artistically and creatively. That is the most important thing. from a personal standpoint, you know, I got a wife, I got a kid, you have a wife, you have two young kids. I think it is important to find a showrunner who matches your vibe, you know? I have worked for single showrunners before who sometimes keep the room just a half hour or an hour later. And to if you have no kids at home and you have no bedtime routine,
yeah,
a half hour, an hour does not make one bit of difference. It doesn't make any difference. If you have a four-year-old at home, a half hour or an hour could be the difference between getting to read a book and doing bath time and saying goodnight and missing it completely.
Yes,
so I think it's advice that you hear to a lot of young writers, which is find a showrunner who sort of matches your lifestyle in a way. And I think it's especially important if you have families. The other thing that I would say is trust, man. Trust. The best showrunners I have worked with and the best experience, and sometimes trust is earned throughout the course of a season. You know, you might not have that trust in the beginning, and by the end, you can do your own thing. But the times when my showrunners have put their absolute trust in my ability to kill it is the time that we have gotten the best work, which is the most 100%. Important thing, and the time that we have been the most satisfied.
Yep.
And I'll say that, shout out to John Wells, TV legend. Look him up if you don't know him. I'm currently finishing up a season of television for him on the Showtime show Shameless. That guy puts so much trust in his writers that it actually is a little daunting because he puts the ball in your court so much that, you know, you have nobody to blame. You know, it's almost like a movie setup like we were talking about earlier. Like you really go off, and it's partly why I'm attracted to it, but you really go off and you make your own episode your own. And then you come back and you live and die by your own words. Of course, the room has some say, and people are pitching jokes and storylines, and you have to, it's a serialized show, so you have to match up where you start and where you end. So it's not 100% yours, but a lot of it is in ways that other shows aren't. And so I think trust for me is a big deal because I am a real screenwriter. You know what I mean? Like I am Kobe. I want the ball in my hands. I don't want to be on the bench watching, cheering on. You know what I'm saying? Like I want to take that last second shot. And it's great if you can really, if you can really prove yourself and really bring the goods, that's the best setup for you. All you other screenwriters who might be scared, you know, that wouldn't work
for
you.
Step off. Yeah. Step off. Anyway, you shouldn't be on a team. But I can't add much because I agree with all of that. And, I agree with all that. And I will say, you know, just full disclosure, I currently work in the John Wells universe. So although John is not our showrunner, we are sort of conditioned to do things a similar way on our show, Animal Kingdom. And I've always appreciated that notion. And on that, I guess the only thing I'll add is just that if I could sum up the type of showrunner I would want to be, and the type of showrunners that I have liked, it's to that basketball analogy for anybody who's a sports fan out there. I think I used to think at a certain point, I used to think that like a showrunner or the better showrunners were LeBron James, or they were Kobe Bryant, or they were Michael Jordan. Those were the best showrunners, right? The best players on the team.
Right.
That's totally fucking wrong. The best showrunners are Phil Jackson, Steve Kerr. You know, those are the guys. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The best showrunners are the people that they may not even be the best. They're not LeBron. Mm-hmm. They're the people that facilitate LeBron. They're the people that facilitate the best players on the team.
Right.
And I think that just that shift in mind state, because I think most showrunners believe they are LeBron James. Mm-hmm. I think that that is the type of showrunner I'd like to be, is it to be the Steve Kerr of the world.
Then I can never be a showrunner because I'm Kobe. Kobe back.
But Kobe back. Wait a second. But Kobe specifically, actually, Kobe was the type of person, the type of player that was an expert at what he did, but he was also expert at, he would have been a great coach.
He was already starting to show that, right? His daughters.
He was expert at like, figuring out what other people needed to do for them to be the best, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Word. I feel that. So Shoot, it is unfortunately time to wrap up this episode of Diversity Hires. We would like to end today, as we always do, or we plan to always do, with a segment I like to call Don't Do That Shit.
Don't do that shit.
And this is where Shu and I get to vent about certain aspects of screenwriting that we hate and that we would advise you not to do, especially if you are a pre-professional or aspiring screenwriter. Don't do that shit. What's your choice for don't do that shit for today?
I got a special 2020 version of don't do that shit. Here it is. Do not in 2020 and going forward describe a character with their age, with their personality traits. Do not do that for a certain amount of characters. And then the other characters do that and say black or and Latino or Latinx or and by default have everybody else white because you didn't indicate their race. So either indicate everybody's race or indicate no one's and let the characters speak for themselves. People should be able to figure out who they are. Don't make white by default.
I love that. That's such great advice. I have to, you know, I have to admit, I've been writing since I was a kid. I've been doing screenwriting in some form since I was a teenager, and I used to do that. And then by the time I hit 17, 18, I was like, what? Like, why am I doing that? White is not the default. I actually try to make black the default in my script. And sometimes I'll indicate this is a white person. And I think it throws people off. And I like that. I like people to be uncomfortable. My don't do that shit for this week is a very specific thing about slug lines. And slug lines, for those of you who are just learning, are the scene headings in the script. Interior, hospital, night, for example. I want to really ask people to stop putting other shit in your slug lines besides day and night. Y'all do that way too much. It's confusing as hell. You have 4 pages of continuous, same, moments later, and I don't know where the hell I am, man. Day and night works. Also, chill with dawn and dusk. Are you writing a vampire movie? Are you writing a Western where the showdown has to happen at dusk? If not, I don't care. Day or night is completely sufficient. Let the director figure out exactly if it's 5:16 p.m. and the sun is like 45 degrees. Like, stop it. Day and night, it's all you need. Simplicity, beauty, stick to it. All that other shit, don't do that shit.
Don't do that shit.
Shu, we got to say goodbye, bro.
All right.
I would like to end today's episode with a J. Cole bar that really resonated with me this morning. Am I free to do that?
J. Cole! I was going to try to throw it like I was, you know, Funkmaster Flexing.
He said, check on my projects like them worker Section 8 appoints, and you'll see how I flip like exclamation points. That's a bar.
You got to break it down. What does it mean?
I feel like people can get it. What I will say is, the lowercase I, flip it upside down, it becomes an exclamation point. I mean, that's just a bar. Like, J. Cole is good for those sneaky bars, bro. Anyway, that wraps it up today for Diversity Hires, and we will see y'all very soon. This has been the Diversity Hires Podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm Sherman Payne.
And I'm Shukri Tillman. Thanks for listening. Our show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton. Shout out to AKB.
Please visit our website, thediversityhires.com, and follow us on social media of your choice. We are at DivHiresPod across all social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
You can find the Diversity Hires Podcast anywhere that you find podcasts.
Smash that subscribe button, homie.
Subscribe, please. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Peace.
Later.